Case number 09-1237, Chamber of Commerce of the United States of America et al., petitioners versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Clement for petitioners, Mr. Ray for respondent, Ms. Keneally for intervener, State of California.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I plan first to address justiciability and then turn to the three principal reasons that the petition for review should be granted, namely that EPA was wrong on the merits, especially on statutory construction, that it applied a fundamentally mistaken standard of review, applying way too deferential a test based on the statutory text in B1B, which requires a finding of a need to meet compelling and extraordinary circumstances, and finally that the EPA failed to appreciate the significance of California's pre-announcement that it would acquiesce in the federal standards once they were promulgated. But let me turn first to justiciability, I think briefly, hopefully briefly, because I think, first of all, the standing of the petitioners to bring this challenge is fairly clear. After all, California themselves admitted that their regulatory scheme would add more than $1,000 to the price of a new car. So in
that's for 2020, right?
I think it's over the life of the regulation.
I think that regulation refers to the price in 2020, and they have considerably lower levels. And my understanding is, to get to that, you'd have to argue that you're going to have to persuade us, I guess, that things matter starting after 2012, right?
Well, and let me take it in turn, because that's why I wanted to start with standing, because I think if you look at initial standing, there's not much question that NADA in particular has standing, and it's, you know, they had, if anything, closer standing than a number of this court's cases recognizing that consumers have standing in comparable circumstances to complain. So I think the real question is one of mootness, and whether or not the twin actions of the federal government promulgating the federal standards and California formally saying what it said it was going to do all along, which is acquiescing in those standards, moots the case. Now, as to that, I think the first thing to get clear is that respondents can't have it both ways on that issue. If this case is indeed moot, then there's no question under this court's case in Aflac and the Supreme Court's decision in Meckling that the right answer would be to vacate the waiver decision of the EPA. And I think what you will hear, I'm not a mind reader or a prognosticator, but I think what you will hear when EPA and California gets up is that they don't want that to happen. They don't want the waiver decision to be vacated. Now, why is that?
Did you argue vacation in your brief?
We didn't argue specifically about the vacater point, but that's because ultimately we think the case isn't moot. But I don't think vacatur is a consequence of a mootness finding under this court's precedent. So I don't think that's something we could forfeit even if we tried. But we didn't. And I think the reason is, as I say, I think ultimately they will say, no, don't vacate the waiver finding. It has continuing consequences. California wants to be in a position if something happens and the federal government withdraws its regulations. Maybe California wants to be in a position to add its own enforcement weight, because a dealer that for some reason found itself selling a non-compliant car would face sanctions both from the federal government, potentially from California. So I think, as I say, I think the way this plays out is that there's essentially a dilemma for respondents. If it's moot, it's really moot, and it requires vacatur. I think they will tell you that they don't want vacatur because this is important, and I think that's ultimately an answer, that there are enough continuing effects from this waiver decision that it satisfies the mootness standard. So without more than, I think I'd like to turn to the merits of this and talk about the EPA's position on statutory construction.
Well, let me go a little too fast. Assume you're wrong on the vacatur, or even assume you're right on the vacatur, but assume that as of 2012, there's no difference. And I take it that's part of your assumption here, that there isn't really a difference, at least with respect to the emissions after 2012. You agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's right.
And so we need, if that does move it, then the only thing we can focus on are between 2009 and 2011 model years, right?
That's right. And I think it would be, in all fairness, I think it would be awfully hard for this court, again, given the fact that model years precede
now,
real years.
Question.
I think it would be very difficult for this court to issue a decision in time. So I think if this court thinks that everything changes in 2012, I think that and finds mootness, then I would urge you, you know, on the Affleck, you were on the panel, Your Honor, so I think you recognize that's a pretty clear decision that vacatur would follow.
Another case not cited in the brief, but you are a late entry as the oral arguer, and oftentimes the oral arguer does think of an argument not represented in the briefs. I understand that.
And again, I think it is, I mean, as I said, the reason it's not in the
brief. You have no other argument then. So if we were to define against you on vacatur, where you don't have an argument after 2012 other than vacatur?
No, I think we do. And like I said, it's a little bit of a prediction game, but I think they will tell you, no, it's not as simple as that, because California wants that waiver finding on the books. It wants it in part because essentially it will allow it to make it easier for them to make a subsequent waiver finding in 2017. They may be able to argue that it's within the scope of the existing waiver finding, and therefore there's a lower standard for getting waiver in the future.
So I see where this is going. This is very interesting. So let me talk to you some more about this. So in Affleck, which probably nobody else knows what we're talking about, before getting to the vacatur point, the court said that consequences for precedent are not relevant to standing. That is, that just because a decision in one case could affect a later decision, that's not enough to give you standing because it's speculative what the consequences would be. Isn't that what we're talking about here? That part of the argument you're making, which is that it would lead to their scope argument or something like that. Is that the same?
First of all, I don't think it is the same because here you're not talking about just the precedential effect of the decision. You're talking about how it affects the same regulator's subsequent regulatory decision. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's exactly the same. I also think, though, that it's not clear to me, I suppose California, you know, can clarify this, but it's not clear to me that even in, say, 2013, that the fact that California has its own separate regulatory regime does not have consequences. In the sense that, as I said, I think if you had a dealer that sold a non-compliant car, now it would have to be a non-compliant car both federally and California, but say a California dealer sells a non-compliant car.
So then now we have the problem of this. We really do have a problem with making an argument not in the briefs, because there's nothing in the briefs at all, fact-wise, with respect to how much the odds of injury to the deal, to the two particular dealers who have been identified, would come from the possibility of both California and the federal government having the same emissions. That is, all of the statements that they've made, which are in their own affidavits, are all about concern that they are not getting things from the manufacturer. You've got to be talking about some kind of aftermarket argument or something. What's a non-compliant car in model year, I don't know, 2013, that's manufactured by a dealer who's bound by a set of federal rules which require them to be compliant? What do you mean by that?
Manufacturer could screw up, right? And you could have a car that's out of compliance, the dealer sells it, it faces sanctions potentially from both the California and the federal government. You know,
now we're starting to sound like the word speculate, which normally doesn't get us to standing.
Well, but that's why I think it's important to distinguish between standing and then mootness. Because I'm not, you know, there's a difference in what kind of...
Is there a difference with respect to speculative effect?
I think so. I mean, yes. You know, even if you have something, I mean, when it comes to mootness, all you need is, you know, essentially some continuing reason why there's a controversy.
Is there a case that says that even a speculative possibility of a future harm is enough to keep a case from being moot? I don't know about that.
I'm sure no judge would have put it quite that way, Your Honor, but I do think there are plenty of cases that stand for the proposition that what satisfies mootness to keep a case in the courts is a lesser standard than what gets it in the first instance. And this isn't sort of speculation. I mean, it's speculation as to whether the sword of Damocles will actually fall. But the fact that you have two entities asserting regulatory jurisdiction, I think that's enough of a continuing injury.
But it's a speculation that's not reflected in the record. That is, it's a speculation based on a new argument. But in Sierra Club, you know, we've talked about this before. You need to put this evidence in the record. The argument about mootness was certainly raised by the red brief. You had a chance by their opposition brief. There was an opportunity to put this argument or facts relating to it in the reply brief. There aren't any facts about the risk of a possibility of a non-compliant car in a dealership in 2013.
Well, and I guess I'm not focusing this so much on a purely factual argument that would need to be sort of documented in the record. I mean, I just think the fact that you have two sovereigns asserting regulatory jurisdiction, even if it's over the same standard, that can only happen because of the waiver finding, right? And without the waiver finding, this would be the EPA would be the only one overseeing these rules.
I think maybe I'm not understanding your mootness argument here. I thought it would be that, let's suppose, I mean, if these are the same in 2012, then this may be moot because the 2011 model year has already happened in effect, right? And you're not really challenging the EPA standard. But on the other hand, if the EPA standard, for whatever reason, is not implemented, California's, congruence would depend on that, right? So they would still have that waiver.
Exactly.
Even if the 2012 EPA standards are never implemented, and under 177, lots of other states could have it, correct?
Exactly. And again, thank you for, referencing the 177 states as well, because, I think at the end of the day, there's a pretty good argument that the 177 states can't pursue their own standard based on the California waiver if California acquiesces in the federal standard, but that's by no means a self-evident proposition.
But the only 177 state for which there's any argument in the record is Maryland, right? You have a Maryland dealer and you have a California dealer. To get associational standing, you have to show an individual member of the association.
Oh, but in the briefing, Your Honor, we referenced all six of the 177 states. Now
you did, but you didn't. You don't have any dealer from any state other than Maryland who's filed an affidavit saying they would be injured. And that is certainly what not only in Lujan, that's what the court said in Lujan. You have to identify the members of the association who would be injured, and you did. You identified one in California and one in Maryland. Right.
And
Maryland. What about Maryland? What's your argument about? I mean, California is governed by this California rule, and Maryland?
As I'm standing at the podium, I don't know whether Maryland is one of the six states, but
it turns out that just like the prospect of hanging and the prospect of an oral argument focuses the attention of the parties and focused your attention, it also focused Maryland's. And so apparently over the weekend, they issued an order saying that they would be bound by California's regulations. So now we don't have any, I know you don't know that, but if you happen to web surf to see whether they had
Sure, but that can't deprive my client of a continuing injury at this point. If that happened over the weekend.
You made a new argument, but now.
Well, this isn't a new argument, with all respect, Your Honor. This is in the briefs. We specifically briefed the fact that we have a continuing injury from the 177 states.
Right, but only one 177 state is represented here. That's Maryland. That's the only one this is our rules about, and Supreme Court rules about associational standing.
Well, obviously, we would, given what happened here, which is, I understand the timeline, is we put in a perfectly compliant affidavit from a Maryland dealer.
Right.
We didn't want to bore you with five other dealers from the other five 177 states. Now, after we put in the affidavit, turns out Maryland gets wind of this and fixes something. At a bare minimum, we'd have an opportunity to get you another declaration. And
that's a very good answer to the question.
So now
we have the other 177 states, and it does seem, on the face of the statute, that they would be bound by California standards, that they can't have a standard that's not the same as California's.
I think it's an arguable point under the statute. I agree with you. At the end of the day, the better view seems to be that they should be effectively, they lose their ability to piggyback on something that California's given up the ability to piggyback on. I sort of agree with that at the end of the day. But it kind of, it's a debatable question. I think we cite a district court decision in the briefs that casts some question on it. And that's an issue that my client would have to spend time and money litigating. And maybe that won't be enough standing, enough injury to get you standing in the front door. But I think it's enough of a continuing effect to keep you in the case. But if I can leave you with one point and then move on, the critical point is they can't have it both ways. If it's moot, then it has to be vacated. And if it has to be vacated, that's something my clients can live with, because then it's not sitting there in the back pocket if the federal government changes its mind, if something happens to the federal regulations, which after all have been challenged, and it's not there to kind of grease the skids for 2017. So if I can turn now to the merits, I think obviously, looking at the merits, the place to start is with the statutory construction argument, and I think the place to start with the statutory construction argument is, can it really be that EPA is right, that California can walk into to the EPA and say, look, we have a new standard we want to add. It's completely and conceitedly unnecessary. But nonetheless, it satisfies B1B because, of course, we have this longstanding program and we still need that. That is essentially the argument that the EPA embraces here today. Of course, in this case, there are arguments that these standards are needed, and I'd like to get to that, but I need to deal with this statutory threshold argument first. And it seems to me there's nothing in the text of the statute to support that view of what B1B means. I mean, you know, I think if Congress wanted to pass a statute that sort of wanted to check to make sure that the basic underlying congressional judgment that California needed its separate emissions program was still valid, this statute would look completely different. It would look more like the triennial review process this court had with the consent decree. It wouldn't be sort of every time you need a waiver, you need to look at B1B. It looks at the standards. Clearly, the right answer is the standards referred to in B1B are the standards for which California seeks a waiver in that particular waiver proceeding. And then if you look at the text of B1B, I think the first thing you recognize is that the extreme deference that the EPA and California invoke throughout their briefs in this court and throughout the EPA's decision is a completely misfit when it comes to the statutory text. Because the statutory text is need to meet a compelling and extraordinary condition. I mean, with all due respect, it sounds a little like intermediate scrutiny or something. It certainly doesn't sound like the clearest, broadest possible discretion imaginable. But that's exactly the way that the EPA has interpreted it. And I think their waiver decision depends entirely on that. If you look at the critical parts of the EPA's waiver decision, every one of them invokes either clear deference or great deference. And this language from the MEMA case, the broadest possible discretion, is replete throughout the decision and their briefs in this case. Now, what's so significant about that is MEMA, of course, didn't involve B1B and went out of its way, actually deferred to EPA's view that B1B is not at issue when it comes to an enforcement standard. MEMA even went so far as to say that if it's an enforcement standard, you could apply B1B because B1B would never be satisfied, which sounds a lot like the court must be assuming that you look at what you're asking a waiver for, not the whole program as a whole. But in any event, what I think is critical is that there's just no way that the EPA can interpret that provision to be as deferential as they did in this case.
And when you say no way, you mean Chevron 1?
I mean either way in the sense, but I would say as to the deference question in particular, Chevron 1, that's right.
And as to whether it refers to the program as a whole, that is all their standards. Is that what you mean by the deference question?
No, I view them as separate, which is there's a threshold sort of statutory question as to whether it's the program as a whole.
Yes, so is that one Chevron 1 or Chevron 2?
I think I can win it at both.
Your brief argues Chevron 1, says it's unambiguous.
No, the brief argues both, Your Honor. At least that's the way I read it. It argues it primarily Chevron 1, but then it says, but this wouldn't even be reasonable, which I view as a step 2 argument.
That would not be reasonable. So if you view that as a Chevron, well, fair enough, Chevron 2 then. So this view about the reading of the statute is inconsistent with every administrator of the EPA's view, right?
Well, two things, sure. It's inconsistent with a lot of prior EPA views, not tested in this court, so I'm not sure how persuasive that is.
Well, really, that every EPA administrator, including the one that came out the way you would like, which in the previous administration, they all either said they had to read it this way, or that is with respect to the whole program, or could reasonably read as applied to the whole program.
Well, but that brings me to the second point, which is I think it's really important to understand the context of this, which is...
But I'm accurate about that point, right?
Yes, you're accurate about that point. But the context is every previous administrator until the one that came out the way we liked was looking at very different waiver requests. They were looking at waiver requests that were at the heartland of the statute, clearly within what Congress had contemplated. And when you're adding sort of one particulate or the like, you can sort of forgive them from not focusing particularly closely on this question, which was not presumably in a lot of those cases the focus.
The one that came out the way you liked did focus on the question and nonetheless said it could be reasonably read the way your opponents now read it. But applying, I guess, Chevron 2, concluded that they didn't have to read it that way, right?
Right, that's right. But I don't think it's an accident that the first administrator that comes up and confronts California trying to do something much different from all the prior waiver requests comes out differently on this question. Because if you take a step back and look at this waiver provision, if it works the way that we say it works and the way that it was applied in all those prior waiver requests, it's a pretty sensible provision about cooperative federalism, which is California gets a shot to deal with a specific problem it has with a California-specific solution. If it's applied here to global climate change, it's a radically different provision. It's California comes in and says, we're trying to solve a global problem. We admit that, you know, we can't solve it by ourselves, but we think if we take action, we can force the federal government to take action. Other nations will follow suit, and eventually we'll make a small dent in this problem. Now, applying that context, this becomes not an exercise in cooperative federalism, but a fairly pernicious provision that blurs accountability for setting national environmental policy. And all of that's tied into this question. I mean, if the statute's interpreted the way that we...
But nonetheless, the administrator in the Bush administration still said that it would be reasonable to read it the way that EPA now reads it. It's just that it's not the better reading.
Oh, and it's hard to imagine what other conclusion the administrator would have made. I mean, the administrator's probably got to take into account prior EPA policy in a way that this court doesn't. So I think if I were that administrator and advising that administrator, I'd probably say, hey, let's take this the easy way, and let's say this is a step two case and interpret this, and you don't need the burden of sort of saying all those previous rulings were essentially wrong. But I don't think this court owes the same kind of deference to prior constructions by the EPA as it does to prior constructions of this court. There haven't been a lot of them. I look at the MEMA case, and I actually think that that decision supports us.
Can I ask you about the text a little bit?
Sure.
So the one argument of your opponents is that when you get to B1B, which says such state does not need such state standards, and the previous reference to state standards says state standards in the aggregate. And so their argument is that it's standards in the aggregate, not the specific standard that was at issue.
And if I could, yes, I'd like as many as three responses to that. One is
you can have
that
five if you want.
One is, Congress obviously...
Like in the last case, prioritize them.
Sure. Know. Well, the in the aggregate language is added later to the statute. It doesn't exist in the original version, and I think it's telling that in the aggregate is added to the first part of the statute, but not the B1B. And it's added to the first part of the statute, which then references B1A, which is expressly deferential language, arbitrary and capricious, doesn't appear in B1B. So that's the first answer.
But B1B is a reference back to something, and the most recent thing is now the use of the word aggregate.
This is a pretty, and I guess I would say the better view is
right. Ambiguous statute, is that what you're
saying? No, what I was going to say is I think the reference is to the standards, not the standards and the modifier. So I think such standards picks up the standards, not the modifier in the aggregate. My second answer would be, though, even if it picks up the in the aggregate, and I guess ultimately this is the reason why I don't think it picks up the in the aggregate, that kind of doesn't make any sense in B1B, and it doesn't do what the government needs it to do. Because in the aggregate, and it's clear from the context in which that was added, really is looking for the net effect. I mean, that's added at the time when California wants to lower its regulation for carbon monoxide below the federal standard so that it can increase even more its other standards. So the idea is the net effect of what California seeks a waiver for will be more protective than the federal standard. The sort of net effect concept doesn't really work in B1B.
If it's not referring to the in the aggregate part, the reference to standards right before that, also in B1, is standards adopted prior to March 30th, 1966.
Yeah, I don't think it can mean that.
Well, it can mean the whole set of standards.
But if it meant that, it would mean the standards before March 30th, 1966. And nobody's ever interpreted it to be simply, does California need the pre-1966 standards?
Well, but so your argument is that it's a reference to A, prohibition? Is that right? That the such state standards is a reference to A, that is the standard that's being challenged. Is that
the standard for which a waiver is being sought?
Correct. So why, if that were the case, is the reference in A to a standard in the singular? while the reference in B1B is to standards. If the question were, I mean, again, if you're talking about how you might write the statute, if you want to be clear, since the first thing, A says...
I'm sorry, are you at 209A? I'm sorry, I'm not...
7543A, which says, no state or any political subdivision shall adopt or attempt to enforce any standard relating to the control of emissions, singular. And then it provides for a waiver as to any state, not as to any standard, but as to any state which has adopted standards prior to 2000, right. prior to 1966. And then it says such state does not, unless such state does not need any such state standards. If they were trying to say it doesn't need that standard, in this case the greenhouse gas one, why wouldn't it say such state does not need such state standard in the singular?
And I guess I misspoke. When you said it was picking up A, I actually misunderstood. I think it does pick up standards in B1. And so...
But we don't know what those standards are.
I think the context supplies the answer. The standards for which a waiver is being sought. I mean, this whole provision deals with how you get a waiver.
But the only reference to, I'm sorry, this is kind of technical, but you're
right. No,
it's very helpful. So if you don't mind me,
I'm here to help.
I'm burning up more time than you don't even have, so it doesn't matter to you.
Exactly.
The part that says what you just said, which is the standard for which a waiver is sought, that's an A.
No.
It's no state shall adopt or enforce any standard in the singular.
But A, remember, is the preemption provision.
Yes.
So you got to get...
That's the only one that... So you're talking about a new state standard, which is preempted unless it fits under the waiver provision.
Everything's preempted unless you get a waiver.
Right.
So it seems to me that's why I would be inclined to look at the waiver provision as kind of the starting point. And then it talks about standards, which I take the... You know, there's also sort of a general rule that we don't get too excited about singular versus plural, and I think here...
If it's in the same section, and you're trying to draw the kind of distinction, we're trying to figure out what they mean when they use the word standards.
Right, but and I guess I would think the right starting place is B, not A. And I certainly, you know, this court in other contexts, including Mima, I think, and maybe it's in Ford as well, sort of, you know, has tried to read those provisions so there's no room between them, so that you can't have something that's preempted and not subject to a waiver. I guess my inclination would be that for purposes of figuring out what standards in B1B means, you are looking primarily at standards in B. One last point, I promised three, and if I could get to the third on this point, which is, I don't think this whole thing really gets the government anywhere anyways. Because, and this is really the point we make in the brief about B1C. The government concedes that as to B1C, if you look at standards in their entirety, is the phrase the government uses in their brief, and ask the question, are the standards in their entirety technologically feasible under B1C? The answer, of course, if there's one standard that's not technologically feasible, but the other ones are, the answer is no. The standards in their entirety are not technologically feasible, because at least one of them is not technologically feasible. I don't see why the same logic doesn't apply to B1B, which is if you ask the question, are the standards as a whole, as a group, are they needed? If one of them is glaringly not needed, then it seems to me the answer is no. The standards as a whole are not needed. And what that brings up is what this, for the, this to mean what the government wants it to mean, it would really have to say the program as a whole without respect to any particular standard. I mean, certainly what it would need to be if it was unambiguous in what they claim it to mean. And it just, it's not subject to that construction. And again, if you take a step back, this would just not be how Congress would write a provision, the sole purpose of which was to ask the agency to check that the animating decision of Congress that put this whole waiver provision there continued to be a valid factual assumption.
You think they're arguing that it's unambiguous? It seems like which would mean Chevron 1. Do you think that's their argument?
No, I don't think that's their argument. I was thinking, to me anyways, it's helpful, even in evaluating step 2 argument, to show the distance between the statutory text and what the statutory text would have to say if it clearly meant what the government suggests it means here. And I think the gap there is too wide. There's so many other ways that if Congress wanted to say, look, we essentially have like a triennial review provision here that every 3 years we want EPA to check to make sure there's a need for a separate California program at all, they just would not have written the statute this way. I'm well past my time, so I'd be delighted to answer further questions, but and hopefully I can get a little bit for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ray.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Norman Rabe from the Department of Justice. With me at council table is Michael Horowitz from EPA's Office of General Counsel and Kathleen Keneally from California's Attorney General's Office. To start off with the question of standing, Your Honor, just briefly, I think Judge Garland basically has it right. This is essentially an evidentiary issue. The petitioners have not established that they are the members that they have identified, and it's only members from the Automobile Dealers Association. The chamber fails entirely to identify specific members.
What about your opposing counsel's argument that starting in 2012, you say it's moot, and our normal disposition in a moot case is to vacate? What do you say about that?
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with that line of cases, that they had not raised that issue before. My understanding, if a case is moot, it's dismissed, and I'm not...
Opposing counsel is correct, actually, that if it really is moot, we would vacate.
We actually did not make the argument that it's moot.
What is the nature of your argument about... So basically, opposing counsel has acknowledged that, since we're already halfway through, I take it, model year 2012, which I take it begins in October of 2011, that the real... We're halfway through 2011, that the issue really starts at 2012. I took your argument to be that in 2012, because of the incorporation of the federal standards into the California standard, that it's moot. And now maybe you're not saying moot. What are you saying about 2012?
Well, I'm saying that they haven't established any injury. It's not moot for one thing, because it's still... The 2010 and 2011 standards are still applicable, so the case clearly isn't moot, at least as to those standards. There's also, of course, the fact that petitioners, among others, have challenged the federal standards.
Well, that cuts both ways, doesn't it?
I don't understand how it cuts both ways.
Well, his argument is that it might be overturned, and therefore they want to overturn yours so that you can also overturn those.
Right. Which is why I believe the case is not moot, because there is interest in these standards. So we have not made the argument that the case is...
All right. Well, in any event, you didn't have a chance to address this.
And we didn't address the issue. Let me make just one point out, one factual issue, which is that one of the arguments petitioner was making with regard to standard had to do with enforcement against dealers. There is no enforcement against dealers. The standards apply to manufacturers, and manufacturers are the ones who have to certify based on compliance. And there's can be either
so,
years. So there's no enforcement.
Opposing counsel said that there could be a risk to the dealer if they had a non-compliant automobile on the lot.
Are no non-compliant vehicles,
right? Because it's
under
fleet.
The greenhouse gas standards, because it's a fleet average.
And there is no enforcement against dealers of any kind.
No, the enforcement is against the manufacturers. It's the manufacturer's responsibility to provide a compliant fleet. So the only injury that they can argue is the one that they've argued in their briefs, which is that they're going to lose money because of sales. And frankly, we don't believe that they have demonstrated that argument factually. Turning to the merits, Your Honor, EPA's interpretation of the statute, so we look at the need provision of the standards as a whole, is clearly supported by the statute. And we should, as always, start with the statutory language. And if we start with 7543B1, what that statute says is the administrator shall waive application of this section to any state, is the initial. It doesn't say as to a particular set of standards, as a particular standard. It says shall waive application of this section being the federal preemption, to the state. So the language right from the beginning of B1 addresses the state and doesn't talk about specific standards. Secondly, the standards that EPA is supposed to look at, the standards that, first of all, the EPA is required to grant the waiver if California demonstrates that the standards in the aggregate are at least as protective as federal standards, unless it can make one of the findings in A, B, or C. So the presumption in the statute is that the waiver will be granted once California makes the protectiveness finding. And EPA has the burden to make one of these other findings if it's going to be, this specifically says, shall waive application of the section. And again, the in the aggregate emphasizes the focus of the statute on the program as a whole, that EPA is to consider all the programs. It simply wouldn't make any sense to consider anything else in terms of the protectiveness finding, because you have to look at whether the standards in the whole are protective. Now, if we get to section B1B, again, as Judge Garland was pointing out earlier, it says such state.
When you say it wouldn't make any sense, I mean, wouldn't it? If you were writing the statute clean and you had a view about a different view than your own about this, your own agencies about this, would it not make sense to say that each part of the each standard within the standards has to be protective?
Well, that was the way the statute was written prior to the amendments in 1977, and that was why the statute was amended in 1977, to allow the standards to be considered in the aggregate, because basically, again, it was a matter of giving deference to California to decide that it was more important for them and more overall beneficial to address their serious ozone problem while at the same time allowing higher emissions of carbon monoxide.
Mr. Clement's argument, I take it, is that the subsequent use of the word such state standards couldn't have been meant to apply to the aggregate point because the aggregate word wasn't in the statute originally.
I'm not sure that's his point, but it simply refers back to state standards. As I think you were pointing out in your discussions with Mr. Clement, what else does it refer to except for those standards that are being considered in the aggregate to be at least as protective?
What do you say about his third point, which is that this argument seems inconsistent with B1C about lead time and technology? I take it that the reference to B1C, we're all talking very shorthand, is to its own incorporation of Section 7521A.
Right, Your Honor. And again, EPA views the standards as a whole in making that determination as well. They all have to be, the same car has to meet all of these standards. So in order for the standards to be achievable, they have to be met. They have to be achievable altogether in the same vehicles. It doesn't make sense to say, okay, you can meet the NOx standard, you consider it all by itself, and you can meet the CO2 standards considered all by themselves. If you can't build the same fleet of cars that will meet both of those standards. The program, EPA's view is that what EPA is reviewing in the waiver and what has to be demonstrated is the program as a whole, because there's only one decision being made here, whether to waive preemption of federal regulation or not, whether to waive preemption of standards. That preemption waiver applies to California's program as a whole, and that decision, in making that decision, EPA considers the aggregate effect in terms of protectiveness. It considers whether it needs its program as a whole in order to meet its compelling needs, and it considers whether the achievability and lead time standards apply to the standards as a whole. EPA views that across the board. And EPA believes that this is wholly consistent not only with the court's holdings in MEMA, but the court in MEMA was relying largely on the legislative history. And the legislative history is also quite clear that what was intended here was to give California considerable deference, to allow California broad discretion to decide how best to protect its citizens, how best to address its air pollution problems. In fact, one of their main argument, and the one that you spent much time discussing, was this argument that by adding in the aggregate, it somehow indicated that Congress did not want the need analysis to be considered separately. But the legislative history from that amendment says The committee amendment is intended to ratify and strengthen the California waiver provision and to affirm the underlying intent of the provision, i.e., to afford California the broadest possible discretion in selecting the best means to protect the health of its citizens and the public welfare. And there are it's similar legislative history from the original enactment in 1966 that Congress clearly intended California to exercise its discretion, to be have flexibility, to serve as a laboratory for innovation, and to take the lead in addressing its own problems. But in part, that was granted because California has historically led and the nation has followed in implementing. The original standards were in place throughout the 40 years since that provision has been in effect. Requirements and technologies that were developed to meet those requirements in California have been adopted as federal standards. And that's exactly what we've seen in this case. California adopted the standards. They've now been granted a waiver. 13 other states decided it was worthwhile, and the federal government has now adopted comparable standards, so starting in the year 2012. It is entirely consistent with the statutory language and with the congressional intent to say that once California establishes that it needs its own program, and no one disputes that California continues to have the most recalcitrant ozone problems in the country, continues to have considerable the most difficult ozone, is the only extreme area for ozone in the country. It has considerable difficulties with PM2.5, all of which are related to, in, at least in part, emissions from automobiles. Given that that there is no question that it needs its own regulation, and therefore that it would not be appropriate to preempt their regulation by imposing the federal standards, once that fundamental preemption decision has been made, the statute envisioned, the legislative history is quite clear, as are this court's precedents, that California is then given very broad discretion to decide how to address those problems, both simply as a matter of, once we've given it to the state to figure out, it's their job to do that and their privilege to do so, and also for the national benefit of allowing California to develop new measures, and then which leads to new technologies to adopt those measures. And the greenhouse gas issues are not, the petitioners present them as a global problem that has nothing to do with California, and that's simply an error. California suffers severely the effects of global climate change from everything from through its water supplies, the impact of wildfires from less precipitation. Its water supplies are already overstressed and overextended, and warmer temperatures, and therefore less snowfall, impacts those as well. Sea level rise will affect California disproportionately because of its high coastal population, as will saline intrusion into groundwater. It's not simply a global problem. It is also a local problem. Global climate change is also related to California's ozone problems. Higher temperatures exacerbate the formation of atmospheric ozone. Lower temperatures will lead to reduced levels of ozone as well. Plus, the regulations have some impact on ozone precursors directly. It's not a matter of California enacting a regulation that has nothing to do with California. These are California problems. The statute allows California to address its problems. And this is not something that was simply adopted willy-nilly. It was adopted by the California legislature. California went through a lengthy, elaborate rulemaking process. To the extent petitioners and other parties had issues, whether the costs and benefits, the relative costs and benefits, they had many opportunities to raise those. They were thoroughly vetted through the California process, and California, as the statute contemplates, made that decision, and 13 other states have adopted that decision. So in short, EPA's reading of the statute, which has been EPA's consistent reading of the statute, that it looks at the issue globally, that California needs its program, and once it needs its program to address its issues globally, that's the end of the story, and that therefore California then has discretion to figure out how to address it, simply subject to the requirements that its program be in the aggregate at least as effective and that it meet the lead time and feasibility standards is a reasonable interpretation of the statute. It complies with congressional intent and this court's decisions, and the decision here should be affirmed.
Can I ask you about the difference in the language between of EPA's review and of our review, I guess, between A and B? Because A defers to the state. That is, if the state determines that that their standards will be at least as protective, then that's subject to EPA's review under arbitrary and capricious. But B doesn't give any sort of deference to the state's determination that it needs it to meet compelling and extraordinary conditions, assuming that a state could have found that it was as protective as the federal standards, separate and apart from some compelling and extraordinary conditions. But B requires EPA to look at this need itself. I mean, not reviewing what California necessarily included, but itself to make this determination.
Right. And EPA, however, has always viewed that the opponents of the waiver, those argument, have the burden of proof, and that stems from the way the whole section is structured, which is if you go back up into the introductory paragraph in B1, it says that EPA shall grant the waiver.
But it then says no such waiver shall be granted if the administrator finds.
That's correct. But at least the way EPA has always read the statute, and we believe is a reasonable reading of the statute, is that the presumption is that the starting point is once California demonstrates that its standards are at least as protective, then the burden shifts to prove that, and that the waiver has to be granted unless one of these three elements are established.
Right, and B puts the burden on the EPA. That is, in the first instance, to say, California, you don't need this, or California, you do need this.
Well, EPA has to make a finding about that. That's correct, John.
But I'm just asking about the difference in A and B, A reviewing what the state has determined, and B putting the responsibility, the initial responsibility, at least it can be read that way, on EPA.
Well, it's because the only thing the statute actually specifically requires the state to demonstrate is that its standards are, and so EPA is then essentially reviewing what the state does, whereas I suppose at least possibly the issue of need could come up as an original matter in front of EPA during the waiver process, because the state isn't required to make that showing in order to get the waiver. EPA is required. It's not specified. If you just read the language of B1, the only thing that B1 specifies that the state has to come in and demonstrate is that its standards are at least as protective in the aggregate as the federal standards.
And all I'm saying is a state could have done everything it needed to do under B1, and still EPA could say, California, you don't need this. You don't meet B.
Right, certainly. If EPA found that the state, for whatever reason, did not need its own set of standards, that its air quality had somehow become so good that it doesn't need the standards anymore, then the waiver would have to be denied. But no one's denying that California needs its own standards. The only thing people are arguing about is whether you should consider this one small piece by itself and decide whether they need that particular piece.
On the point you were just asking, I thought we held in MEMA that the burden is on the challenger, not on the state.
Yes, that is our position. That the
well,
burden
your position,
is
as you just stated, was that that's what you reasonably concluded from the statute. But
you've also
although I must say that is a strong and originalist and textualist position, here we are bound by our own precedent, which also says the same thing.
Thank you for reminding me that, John. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kathleen Keneally for the state of California. I'd like to address, as my time is short, I want to address one thing on enforcement against dealers. There were some questions about that. Under California law, dealers may not sell uncertified vehicles of any sort, motor vehicles. There's a bunch of other vehicles that the law reaches. Now, with respect to the GHG emission standard, that's part, of course, of our overall program, the program that we've been talking about. And what manufacturers must do, not dealers, but manufacturers, is they make a certification showing with every model year to ARB. They come in, and now GHGs are one piece of that, but for their all the vehicles they want to sell in California, they do that based on projections. And at the end of a five-year period, there's an accounting that's done. So it's determined at that point in time whether or not the overall fleet was compliant with respect to GHGs. So number one, there will not be an individual car on a dealer lot that could be sold where a dealer, I think, would be subject to a penalty because that vehicle didn't comply with the GHG standard. However, dealers can be enforced against under our laws for selling uncertified vehicles.
You probably realize you're arguing against your own position here.
I'm not. I don't think, Your Honor. Are you talking about the mootness
yes.
argument?
Yeah.
Right. You know,
I mean, we should know what the
sure.
facts are, but...
But I think, here's what I think about mootness. I recognize Mr. Clement brought up a brand new argument, so I haven't read AFLAC, at least not very recently.
No, but the question is, it's not really related to AFLAC. The question is, in what way would the dealers be injured if with respect to California-only compliance as compared to federal compliance? And he was talking about the possibility of enforcement against a dealer. The EPA said you don't have to worry about that. Dealer won't be injured because California doesn't enforce these GHG regulations against dealers. Now, are you contradicting that argument?
What I'm saying is I want to make it clear that there are enforcement provisions that go to the certification of motor vehicles in California that do apply to dealers if they sell an uncertified vehicle. That's a fact.
Well,
okay.
The certification that we're talking about here is the fleet-wide
That's
certification,
right.
correct?
And there's a distinction.
Can a dealer be, and can there be enforcement against a dealer for the fleet-wide requirements?
No,
okay.
There's not. And I wanted to make sure, though, that that was clear because the larger statement was made. There certainly is. It's very important that, you know, dealers comply with the overall selling of certified vehicles as opposed to uncertified vehicles. So I want to address that issue. The other thing I want to address is the idea, in May of 2009, there was a nationwide deal struck with respect to greenhouse gases among the federal government, most of the motor vehicle manufacturing community, California, and basically that deal, this nationwide program that we're talking about, is GHGs only. It's not the overarching program or the program as a whole. So there is a distinction to be made. Now, California did not say it would accede to the federal standard. What we said is that we would accept the federal standard. If the federal GHG standard is equivalent to ours, we would accept that compliance demonstration by the industry as compliance for our standard. And in our letter, and in many of the letters, I don't know if it's in the dealer's letter, but it's specifically stated and that we understand that our longstanding authority under the Clean Air Act is not affected at all by this deal. What we were doing is we were allowing harmonization of this particular standard because there's overlapping authority. There's NHTSA has some authority, but it's wholly separate from EPA's and California's, as the Supreme Court in Massachusetts versus EPA said. So it's not true that we simply stood back and acquiesced in the federal government standard. We have an entirely different program, and we are harmonizing on the GHG standards with the federal government. So I see my time is almost up, and I will sit down unless the court has further questions of me.
I just want to make sure that I understand, because Mr. Clement, one of his points was that EPA failed to appreciate the significance of your pre-announcement that you would go along with the federal standards. And your point is that it was contingent on a lot of different things. In other words, you were not ceding your authority. You were not saying you did not, quote, need these standards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you.
Why don't you take a couple minutes?
I appreciate it. I really have 3 points I'd like to make. One, just as a clarification, I mean, the government suggested they didn't argue mootness. I mean, on page 14 of their brief, at the very top, they say, furthermore, declarants' claims that they will lose sales to dealers in other states has been mooted by the recent adoption of the federal standards for model year 2010 to 2016 that are essentially equivalent to the California standard for which the waiver was granted. I certainly read that as being a mootness argument. Second, on the MEMA case, which both sides rely on, I think we have the better argument in relying on it. One thing that's clear about MEMA is that it didn't address B1B. So on the question of who bears the burden, MEMA is perhaps persuasive authority that a challenger bears the burden, but it doesn't hold that because MEMA it expressly said that it wasn't a B1B case. And more importantly, though, I think MEMA...
It's a waiver case.
It's a waiver case. And
it's it's always a hard line drawing between dicta and holding, but it said that for waivers, the person opposing the waiver has the burden.
It does, and I would say that, you know, that, like I said, that's probably persuasive on B1B. I don't think it's a holding on B1B, because the court's actual, one of its holdings is that B1B is inapplicable to an enforcement standard. The B1B only applies to a new standard. But the court's reasoning on this point, and it's on page 1113 of the opinion, I think is telling, because what the court says, if the administrator was entitled to deny a waiver upon a finding that California did not need a particular enforcement procedure to meet compelling and extraordinary conditions in California, it is unlikely that a contested waiver request would ever be granted. Now, that sentence assumes, this is the court assuming, that at least as an enforcement proceeding, that what you would apply B1B to was that particular proceeding, that which a waiver was sought. You wouldn't apply it to the whole program in the abstract, or that sentence doesn't make any sense. And that sentence is part of the court's holding, I would submit. The last point I would like to make is just about, this is picking up on Judge Henderson's point about the difference between B1A and B1B. Now, we've had this colloquy about whether or not the burden of proof is on the challenger for B1B. I'll sort of concede that maybe the better reading based on MEMA is that the burden of proof should be on the challenger. But that's not the same thing as whether deference is appropriate. And with all due respect, I think the government engaged in double counting here. The odd language of the statute that sort of says that the administrator shall find unless, I mean, that might be enough to shift the burden of proof, but it's not enough to give deference to California's decision. And I think here's where the administrator really made an error in its analysis on this issue, because on B1A, the right question is, look at what California found, and that's in the protectiveness determination as to which in the aggregate is directly relevant. On that question, look at what California did and ask yourself, is it arbitrary and capricious?
That's a deferential standard.
That's a deferential standard. B1B requires the secretary to make the administrator, rather, to make her own finding about whether or not the need standard is found. And if you look at the administrator's decision, and I would particularly point you to the key parts of it, you know, 74 CFR 32763, this is where the logical link between ozone and greenhouse gases is found. She invokes clear deference. Clear deference to whom? Clear deference to California. And then on the equally important sort of relationship that there's a rational relationship between sort of greenhouse gases and California's problems, and this is on 74 CFR 32766, she invokes, quote, great deference. And I really do think that that's a mistake, that is applying deference. And whatever, I mean, if the sort of backwards language shifts the burden, so be it. But there's nothing about B1B that suggests deference. And I think particularly if you contrast the language in B1A, which is all about deference, arbitrary and capricious, what could be a clear indication of deference, and B1B, it shows that the administrator did not proceed in the right way. For those reasons, petition for review should be granted. Thank you.